because I want to have something to say. And you know, when you leave, you feel there's so many things you haven't said. It's always, of course, wrong, because you have said already something. But I may fall into that trap. Now, I want to talk tonight about modern poetry between praise and lament. And the real subject is the Spanish poet Jorge Guillén, who taught at Wellesley College, where Eleanor went to, but she wasn't aware of him, that he was there. This is what happens, you see, if you aren't properly informed, that one of the greatest poets of the 20th century is right there in the college, and the students who are there don't even catch a glimpse of him. Now, I thought that I'll begin with a general introduction about the situation of modern poetry, then move to the Spanish poet, and in the end read to you one of his longer poems in five parts. But I thought that, you know, we get into a certain rut as teachers and as speakers. Why do it that way? Why not begin with the poem? Because probably you are freshest now, and you will wilt as the lecture proceeds. And so I'll read the poem now with a few comments, then speak about the situation of modern poetry, and then tell you who's the poet and whose poem you heard. So we'll begin with the words of the poet himself. This is a cycle. If you have the book, it's on page 113. It is a love poem entitled Anillo, the Ring. And it is a love poem. It is a love poem in five parts. And you know, to write love poetry is very difficult. We have, you know, centuries, really millennia, of love poetry, and it seems that the subject has been almost exhausted. And so many of the modern poets really then are trying to be sensational, they try to be very daring, you know, they go into physiological details and want to make their love poetry interesting that way. Now, Guillén is describing in this poem two lovers on a summer day together. He describes their love, and it is really a celebration of flesh. I've been talking about this, and so has Dr. Wolf. It's a celebration of flesh, it's a celebration of the totality of the human being, and it is a human being really where you can separate the spirit from the flesh. You cannot separate the element of love from life itself. And this ring, the embrace of the lovers, the darkened room on a hot summer day, and extends, as the poem progresses, into really a dialogue with the meaning of the universe itself. And it moves the seasons, summer, winter, and finally it ends with an evocation of death. Is death really the contradiction of life, or merely its last step? I have talked a great deal in these weeks about the vision of the unity of being that some of the finest poets have presented in their poetry. And this vision of the unity of all being, the interdependence of everything that lives under God, this vision has been expressed perhaps most strongly and originally by this contemporary Spanish poet. I'll read it to you, and we'll comment on the way, and we'll read here and there some examples of the Spanish. So, The Ring by Jorge Guillén. Here the heat grows secret, a refuge now of glad shadows that two lovers can share, flickering half shadow, but not a human sigh floating anywhere. Our best dreams now come alive. Indoors, deep afternoon, in the secrecy of a chamber, no one knows where. Treasure always the same, with its splendor complete, has gone into hiding between the rays of light. The flowing back and forth of a luminous silence twists a trembling fiber of light into threads between the window blinds. Haunt of repose. The lover's hope quivers in the motes of dust. Out of the unmoving dark, the pillow offers the happy two a whole summer of a dazzling white, so fortunate that it is changed into the highest human accord. Like a flowing breeze, the whiteness freshens the air. The shore spreads out, the shore surrenders itself. No desire ventures eagerly toward the shadow, loitering on the shore and on the naked body. The two that are happy, in the solitudes of their own climate, safe beyond any winter, search in the ageless weavings of light and shade for a full radiance of eternal summer. There is so much fullness in the present moment, tranquil between the palms of destiny's hands, that our running course, that the running course of one instant lingers slowly, gracefully, delighted into love. From within, profound accumulations are raising the level of a plateau where the present moment fills and fixes the center of so much immensity made solid now. The restlessness of the sun on the wooden floor, sunlight with the murmuring of the street, that besieging the silence only encourages it. This ardent desire circling the same figure, and suddenly free space, a sierra, at the mercy of a wind that makes one drunk, a fragrant wind that banishes from the earth every trace of unlucky history. Where are these things? When do they happen? History is gone. It had passion. It was this passion. One day alone, grown profound in the memory, entrusts itself to the present moment forever. Now this first part then sets the scene. The lovers in this secluded chamber on a summer day near the sea, and the symbolism of the lovers meeting, their desire for one another, is later, at the real climax of the poem, compared with the waves reaching for the shore. And history is gone. There are moments within history. Man is not only an animal of history, only a social animal. He's also a part of nature. He's also a part of the larger context of creation. And within tragedy, there are moments of happiness. Within war, there are moments of peace. And these moments, Guillain celebrates. Now the second part. Although desire hurries a cult of worshippers into an ecstatic crowd, it strikes yet another road and guides the tumult into reverence without hindering the rebirth of desire. Womanly beauty waits upon the summit and, yielding everything, acts with modesty at a distance. How ideal and how true, so improbable and yet so immediate. It is so central to all, so absolute, the earth utterly plunged in the universe, so intensely created without ceasing, how much fruit in its smooth contour exists in a single season. Love is here, faithful infinity that cannot possibly end all at once. A sudden meteorite launching its attack of the absolute. Oh, sudden sweetness, there is no surprise, for the great gladness only fulfills the dream, and the soul comes to uplift the flesh and to ease the loneliness of the world in its lament. Now in the third part, the meter changes. Joy of joys, the spirit under the skin, and before the lovers the garden that lives always. A paradise created out of woman and man, the tree supremely good, casting no shadow of evil. Now, the rhythm is not the same, of course, as in the Spanish. It changes from the iambic to the trochaic. Joy of joys. Gozo de gozos, el alma en la piel, ante los dos el jardín inmortal, el paraíso que es ella con él. Literally, the paradise that is she with him. You know, and the English says the paradise created out of woman and man, which is different. Optimo el árbol sin sombra de mal. The best of trees without the shadow of evil. Then it goes on. Nothing except life. Here are the lovers. A sweet harmony of mountains and rivers, dawning in the far distances of the east, turns innocent the two free wills. Where do they put on their ordinary appearance? Who is it surges here? Welcome, immediate, yet lasting, mystery solid in the hands. May a form so clear preside over an innocence of rapture. Is it woman's beauty that is so captivating, or is it the whole urge of summer that drowns in a terrible happiness? And now comes this counterpoint all the time, the lovers and the sea. O blessed fury of the sea, this wave is not blind. Still frolicking, their mouths toil eagerly, inexorable with the power of entreaty. The laughters of June among the rocks shatter the limpid blue with their games. Does an aggressive urge rest in their arms? Softly, silently, harmony resists. How much of the sea's stillness there is up there! Not a crash that the cliff does not silence. And those violent two clutch at each other in the tenderness that links them together. And the rejoicing of the elements turning, turning again at the edge of the sand. They need their knees arranged humbly now on purpose. Know of a sun that assaults the spirit. The salt breath of high breeze reaches to the horizon on the heights of the coast. Happiness, the avalanche of the act of love, slides clear to the feet, twisting them into fire. The Asia creaks. A sinuous warmth goes warping the curve of the sky. Joy of being, the lover lies in his spasm. Oh, extraordinary present, spent now. Oh, reality. O torrent in full flesh, everything is a latent, astonished cry. On every hand the summer reaches its consummation. The yellow afternoon is a circle. Without a cloud, the neighboring sky descends on this passion, this clay, more than human. So here you have the lovers meeting. You have the sea meeting the land. And in the end, it is really the summation of the summer, of the passion. The afternoon closes like a circle. And in the end, he says, this passion really is more than human. It is more than mere clay. It is expressive of really a secret of the universe itself. Glory of two, but without letting happiness hinder their retreat toward the rest of darkness, the whole globe circles around their pillow. The flower on the wallpaper springs alive. A common weariness places the outspread body in touch with the soul that also lies outspread, richly alone, already possessor of the twofold calm. This is a repose of so sweet a burden, tumbling so softly down, yielding, sinking further, finally deepening the delight of two destinies in a single place. Some men shatter their voices and rend themselves deep inside in melancholy confusion. Nevertheless, can you hear the healing lullaby of the air in the tall reeds? The air, terrible gale or wind or breeze, resounding or falling into a hush, always pure nakedness exists. Doesn't even the saddest man perceive it, as though with the eyes of a god? Let me read again this one stanza. Some men shatter their voices and rend themselves deep inside in melancholy confusion. It's the briefest definition of quite a bit of modern literature. But Guillain's answer is, nevertheless, in spite of it, can you hear the healing lullaby of the air in the tall reeds? And he says, doesn't even the saddest man perceive this fullness of reality as though with the eyes of a god, seeing the symbolic meaning of all existence and not merely its present limitation? And now from this meeting of the lovers, the extension of the present moment that includes the summer, that includes an affirmation of all being, Guillain sums it up in the widest circle of these five parts. This is the last part. And it begins truly majestic. And the lover's whole being, tranquil in its strength, sinks back into the peace of the universe. The enormous peace that gives shelter from war, everything gathered into the huge tide. Now, this is not a very good translation. One of my favorite stanzas in this long poem. Literally, the Spanish is, and all being becomes submerged, or submerges itself, tranquil with vigor, you see, serene and yet full of strength, vibrant strength, in the peace of the universe, the enormous peace that gives asylum to war. That's a different thing than the enormous peace that gives shelter from war. See? It is really the peace that surpasses all understanding. It's very hard really for us to understand that there is this universal peace within which evil exists, within which war exists. It is such a large concept of peace that it can give asylum to war. We can't understand it. Everything gathered into the huge tide. Let me read this in Spanish. y se sumerge todo el ser tranquilo con vigor en la paz del universo. La enorme paz que da la guerra asilo, todo en más vasta pleamar inmerso. And the next stanza. The irresistible circle of creation. That's what Guillen is talking about. It really, the poem begins like a pebble, you know, dropped in a lake. And then it draws wider and wider and wider circles of universal implication. In the center is the Eden, is the paradise of the two lovers in their chamber, the summer day by the sea. But the implications are of much wider significance. The irresistible circle of creation spreads out over the universe like a great longing, like the sympathy of wave falling on wave that is uplifted into a human hope. This is irresistible circle of creation spreads out over the universe like a great longing, really like a great delight, Spanish, like a sympathy that of wave to wave, and here again, like man to man, wave to wave, which all kind of climaxes in the human hope. What is the human hope? Clear stream over the stone and gravel. Don't you want to pause on your way to dying? Love in creation, in flowers, in children. Where are you going without fear of death? Yet it's true that the lovers really don't think in the moment of fulfillment and their love of death. In their real moments of happiness, we do not think of death. And is it wrong? How beautiful, so much space before the summit. Love is always life. It is only life. There is no gaze of love that does not give birth to its eternity. It nests there in secret. O endless present, now that lasts forever, with a continual freshness of the dew, and knowing nothing of evil or of winter, absolute in this inner chamber of summer. Incredible absolute, hidden in this mind that love discovers, searching along in the midst of time that marches towards its ruin, guiding our difficult life. So he's aware, you see, of history, of tragedy, our difficult life. And yet there seems to be a contradiction here. There are these moments when we feel whole, and we feel the eternity of the moment and we don't want it past. And then, of course, dissonance, winter, death, time, history engulf us again. But we should not forget these moments. Both are profoundly indicative of the human condition. One is not without the other. And this is what many overlooked in the 20th century. Many poets, many thinkers, many people. They think we are unique because we suffer, because we have world wars, because we have injustice. It has always been with us. So much of the present truly cannot pass. And now comes a line that is just tremendous. Happy the river that passing yet remains. Feliz el río que pasando queda. Happy the river that passing yet remains. Isn't that really the briefest definition of human life? You pass, of course, with the years, you age, you are a subject to time. And yet there is something that remains, that really never changes. O fortunate time, let us see your house. This love is already lucky without fortune's wheel. Concealed by voices and by gestures, nimble still in spite of so many bonds, the lovers live joyously on two contraries between the tangling lattices of their embrace. In the deep shade, the sun's rays still move. The breadth of the immense afternoon is circling beneath the secret of a light so gentle. Love under the sun flourishes and grows strong, and they stand upright, secure, two destinies confronting the chance of the days. Sometimes stony, sometimes like a diamond, all days will shine love if you are their guide. May the afternoon be the sun's. The earth will never spin upon a stronger brace. The circle closes itself around the spirit. Now do you surrender, death? Really, it is a poem about death. How can we live amidst dying, amidst the ravages of time and history, the political injustice, the social injustices, and for quite a few people, the shadow kind of cancels out the light. Now, Guillén's poetry reminds us that there is a larger concept of God's creation that gives asylum to war, that immerses everything in a larger tide. And if we want to be fully human, we cannot play out one side against the other, but we must strive for this point of view that embraces all of man and all of creation. Happy the river that passing yet remains. That's the secret. It is the same river, and we know, of course, it's never the same. With every moment, we change, and yet we are the same. Now, you can concentrate upon the passing and really go out of your mind. You can also concentrate only on that what you are, essentially, and overlook the reality around you. Neither of these extremes are justified. It is the constant balance between the two which makes our human life, for Guillén. It's difficult to maintain that balance. It is a difficult tension. But that is the human destiny, to live in this tension, to see life as a tragedy shot through with moments of real exaltation. And love certainly is a central revelation of the meaning of life for Guillén. Now let's step back for a moment. Leave the poem alone. If you think of the formulas that have been used for the literature of our century, probably such formulas as Age of Anxiety, coined by W.H. Auden, comes to mind. The weak claw, the no exit of Sartre, the stranger of Camus, the waste land of Eliot, or Kafka's The Trial, where a man is arrested and put in trial, and he doesn't know what for, and the whole book deals with his searching what for his guilt. And in the end, he is killed like an animal. Accusation, lament, outcry dominates the literary scene in the 20th century. Estrangement, alienation, rebellion, isolation are key words in the vocabulary of philosophy, of theology, in the writings of historians. And this is, of course, not surprising, considering the two world wars, genocide, mass murders, and violent upheavals, social revolutions, breakthroughs in science that have radically changed our concept of reality and kind of somehow taken away the safety and security that we felt still in the 19th century. God is dead, one hears again and again. On the one hand, there is a loss of faith. On the other, an indulgence in materialism, in hedonism, in sensuality for sensuality's sake. Now, especially the modern drama and the modern novel reflect this nihilism. Modern poetry does also. It's Think of the wasteland of T.S. Eliot. But less so. That's the main point. How come? Have the poets not lost their faith? Do they not see the injustice and the crimes around them? Of course they do. But their view of reality was never entirely determined by the social order alone, nor did it depend exclusively on one spiritual religion or its tenets. The poets have been aiming at a more inclusive view of reality that reaches from the particulars of nature and things to their symbolic universal implication. Just as Guillain doesn't stop with a mere description of a summer day and a lover's happiness. Nature and the world of objects is still with us in spite of social and historical changes. This can be a source of solace, joy, faith, and hope. Man is not only a spiritual, political, social being. He is also a being of nature and the flesh. He is a living totality within the larger unity of creation, a creature of God's creation in Christian terms. Even if he despairs about the social and historical injustices of his day, and there certainly are many injustices, no one is denying them, and the poets are the last ones to do so. The question that several modern poets pose to modern men is this: why despair to this extreme, as if wars, death, evil, crime, annihilation, tragedy, injustice had not been with us since the dawn of man? Why should such remedies as courage, endurance, self-discipline, humility, consideration towards others suddenly no longer be effective in the 20th century? Why believe that modern man faces sorrows and perplexities greater than any other previous age? Think of Job, think of Jeremiah, Ecclesiastes, think of the Greek tragedy, think of Dante's Divine Comedy, think of Dostoevsky. Because we have the H-bomb and we orbit the Earth, has this changed our place in the total order of things? Has it kind of fundamentally changed the nature of man? Some scientists, quite a few scientists, philosophers, even theologians, would answer in the affirmative. Most poets would answer probably in the negative. We coddle modern man, that is ourselves, too much, by believing that our age is somehow unique, and with it also we ourselves are unique. That we can lose our nerve freely because it's a unique situation. Scream, behave idiotically. In short, indulge in the negative aspects of childhood again. I've spoken about the positive aspects that should be salvaged and that are kind of the creative impulses in man. And we saw them last night in operation. But there are negative aspects. Reserve, tact, balance, maturity, self-discipline, serenity. These are qualities one can strive for, I think, even today. At least I believe that. The poet, therefore, tends to be skeptical of modern man's uniqueness and his pride. He stresses the things that have endured through all the social and historical changes and still surround us today and comfort us, if we care to see and look attentively at all. The reality of love between man and woman, parent and child, the beauty of the body, nature and things, the four seasons that Pasternak celebrates in his novel that I discussed with you some time ago, the four elements that still cradle, warm, wash and refresh us. How can we overlook all of this in our despair over social, political, and scientific changes? We should be concerned with social and political injustices, combat them to the best of our ability and our courage. But must we therefore overlook the other aspects of reality around us? That's the question. This is the fundamental question, I think, posed by quite a few of the 20th century poets. And because the poets do not see reality exclusively in social, philosophical, or political terms, they have managed to retain more hope and humility, a sense of wonder and celebration. A poem by Guillain is a poem of celebration, of love, of life in the flesh, of the summer, of this ultimate sympathy and this larger concept of universal peace that cradles all of it, the earth itself, like a fruit. They have retained more of this sense of wonder and celebration than most novelists and dramatists, who seem to have it lost, and let's hope, just for the time being. I'm not saying with this that more poets are Christian than other modern men, no. But I am implying that poets tend to have more reverence before the complexity, the diversity of life, of reality, and thus, deep down and often, not even admitted, a religious concept of reality. They have a vision of the unity of all being that I mentioned before. And this is the reason why I've attempted to bring poetry, and modern poetry especially, closer to you. The image of modern man and contemporary reality presented by the modern novels and plays must be balanced by the view presented by modern poetry to get the whole picture. Most people just read novels and see some plays and judge from them that the world is really a mess and going to pot. It can't last very long. Absurdity, meaninglessness, is all that can be said about human life or reality in the 20th century. Really? Wonders the poet. Could it not be that many of the dramatists and novelists, philosophers and theologians, and historians of total despair in the first half of our century, that they represent the last agony of the 19th century that was destroyed in two world wars? A world of materialism, of faith in science and positivism, a world of bourgeois and middle class solid values, a static worldview. Could it be that some of the great poets and theologians in the first half of this century, who looked for completely new approaches to the problems of human existence and reality, and did not lose courage or hope, may it not be that they have been forerunners of a new dawn in the arts, in literature, in philosophy, in theology, that is already on its way in this second half of the 20th century? Of course, where there is new light, there is also a new shadow. And there is a great deal of confusion with us. But we tend always to concentrate on the confusion, on the dissonances of modern life. And we do not even know that there is a poet like Jorge Guillén in our midst. Listening here at Holden to the lectures of Dr. Wolf, experiencing your response to Boris Pasternak's novel and the poems in his Dr. Zhivago, Dr. Living, which is also a novel of celebration, and to my mind, one of the novels that points to the future. Seeing your interest about modern poetry during these weeks, I am tempted to be optimistic. The life work of the Spanish poet Jorge Guillén, whose poem I read in the beginning, is another reason, I think, for optimism. So let's turn now to him and his work. The American poet Archibald MacLeish once exclaimed in wonder when he first was introduced to Guillén's Cantico, I quote, Posterity, if it comes upon the great resounding yes of Cantico among the tumbled fragments of our time, will not believe that no was all we had to answer to the world. I think that expresses the briefest possible form, the essential achievement of this poet. Posterity, if it comes upon the great resounding yes of Cantico among the tumbled fragments of our time, will not believe that no was all we had to answer to the world. Who is Jorge Guillén? Well, he was born in Old Castile, in the center of Spain, in 1896. He attended, I hope I'm right in that, there's a chronology here at the end, 1893. I made him younger, I'm sure he'll be happy for that. He studied in Switzerland and France, and he got a PhD in literature and taught at several universities. He was part of this great generation that flourished before the Civil War broke out in Spain, to which belongs Lorca, who most of you probably know, the philosopher Ortega, Unamuno. It is a tremendous period in Spanish literature. Really, if I were pressed to say which are the two literatures that have contributed most to modern poetry in the 20th century, I would say Spain and Russia. Russia, between 1890 and 1930, and Spain from 1890 to 1936. Both of these literatures have produced more major poets in a short span of time than any other literature in Europe that I know. This is a very amazing fact. And so Guillén belongs to this generation, and we are slowly discovering the poets besides Lorca. Guillén is one, Alberti is another. If you read that little anthology of modern European poetry, you'll find several others. And this tremendous Renaissance was cut down by the Spanish Civil War, and in Russia by Stalin's deep freeze that set in around 1930. When he started dictating socialist realism to the artists. Most of the major Spanish poets left the country, Guillén among them. Lorca was shot by a fascist firing squad. Guillén escaped and came to the United States, and he taught at Wellesley for quite a few years until he retired. Now he lives in Italy and comes once in a while to visit his children who live in America. Now Guillén devoted 31 years of his life to the writing of one book entitled Cantico, or Song of Praise. It began in 1819 on a beach in France, right after World War I. And it continued through the vicissitudes of the Spanish Civil War, Guillén fleeing his country, becoming a refugee in the United States, the Second World War, and yet the book continued to grow like a tree. Four editions were published, and each edition expanded the basic design. Guillén wanted to write one book that would kind of include his whole life and not publish a whole series of little collections of poems. So he has this tremendous architectural will that I can only compare with Dante. After the completion of Cantico, which has 334 poems in its final edition of 1950, Guillén embarked on a second cycle. You see, Cantico is a song of praise. And it celebrates the moments of fulfillment. It is really a poetry of youth and of early manhood. Summer, noon, these are the times that dominate the volume. Shadows, winter, death are in the background like a chorus, as Guillain says, but the singing voice is one of fulfillment and happiness. History and society are marginal. In the second volume, which Guillain completed after some 15 years, the second volume is called Clamor, Outcry. And the subtitle of the second volume is Time of History. And there you see Guillain presents the other basic mode of human reaction, of man's reaction to reality. Namely, as subject of history and society, he suffers. He sees injustice and evil, which contradicts his moments of happiness and fulfillment, his essential goodness. And so in that second volume, we have satire, irony, death, lament, epigrams. But the second book is not a contradiction of the first. As Guillain himself says, it's only the reverse of the same coin. But most poets usually interweave the moments of praise, the songs and the laments, you see. The praise and the lament. And Guillain has separated them to show kind of very intensely two basic modes of human life. And especially Cantico as an exemplary, really, quality. In the moments of my greatest despair, it has helped me immensely. And once I talked with Guillain, I told him how much it helped me when I was in the army, and I felt a complete zero, and I felt really, I mean, that I had nothing anymore to say. And Cantico helped me so much, and I said, I don't know whether this was what he planned. And he said, oh yes, he says, you can read it also as a handbook against suicide. Because certainly in Guillain's life, there was a great deal of suffering. I mean, certainly it's not a happy life at all. A refugee and a man away from his country, and there are other very dramatic things in his life. But Guillain had the courtesy of the heart, you can say, not to pour out all of this unhappiness upon the world, not to add to it, but to overcome it with his love and understanding, because that's what we need. And it seems to me that so many artists just let themselves go and think this is everything that we need. I've said sometimes to some of my classes, really, to say that the world is meaningless, that the world is tragic, really is nothing. That's realism. We all know that's true. Basically, that's true. What you expect of an artist is that he have a little bit more to say. That he can somehow give us hope, that he can refresh us, that he can show us some other sources of meaning besides merely stating that man in time and history is doomed. And Guillain's Cantico is one constant attempt to affirm in spite. Now, critics have accused him that Guillain somehow doesn't see the misery of the world. He certainly does. But does it help to dwell upon the misery, to carp upon it all the time? But it takes courage, it takes consideration, it takes love, it takes faith not to do it. The third book, on which Guillain is working right now, is called Homage. Reunion of Friends. And this homage contains his translations of some American poets, French poets who have meant so much to him. There are poems of travel, poems dedicated to friends and acquaintances. And these are the three basic modes of the human voice. You can sing in praise, you can cry out in lament, or you can pay homage. I thought that the three cycles together, Guillain would call vox humana, the human voice, because it's really the whole range of the human voice, and it's the whole range, really, of human experience. But he wants to call it aire nuestro, our air, the air around us. That's very surprising. But it is very deeply embedded in his poetry. There is one long poem called Air, a poem about air, about nothing. And Guillain says, begins the poem, air, almost nothing, and yet everything. There's an early prose work by Guillain, which he published in the late 20s, called Aire Aura, Air Aura, where he studies the ascension of Christ. And he said that Christ could have only ascended. And that the air and the heaven and our breathing are very closely interconnected. The fact that the earth has this wrapper of air, which really gives life to this planet and to us, is a miracle. Really, you don't need any other proof of God's grace than the fact that we have air to sustain us and give us life. And it's being given the same way as the light of the sun, without any consideration to the sinners and the saints, both. What kind of logical proofs do you need besides this constant mercy? Hopkins says in a poem, we are with mercies wound around and round as if with air. And this is what Guillain means. It is really this intangible, it's the air. It is really the most essential things are spiritual, intangible, not the material, not the heavy, not the static, not the rock. But it's the sea, it is the air that we breathe, it is the clouds that sail by, it is this lightness and light, which to him are the real values and the real mystery of human existence. And he sings the praises of it. So Aire Nuestro and the three parts constitute really something like a modern Divine Comedy. Dante's Divine Comedy, you remember, has hell and purgatory and paradise. And Guillain doesn't have hell and purgatory, he has clamor, his outcry. And it's very interesting, although Guillain himself says that he is not really, I mean, he's not a Catholic, he doesn't go to church. But I told him, how can you say that? You know, really, I mean, you're not dogmatically, maybe, you know, a Christian. But your poetry is really one great expression of a Franciscan spirit of love and kindness. And he said, well, in a letter, a long letter, he said that, well, my mother was a very devout Catholic. And I am not like her, you see. So I feel really, I am not. Strictly speaking, I mean, really, I couldn't call myself a Christian. But he says, you are right. I'm profoundly Christian in Christ. In the Cantico, there are two poems. One is the birth of Christ, Christmas poem. The second poem is called Sabbath of Glory, and that praises the resurrection of Christ when the no is conquered and the yes triumphs. And in Clamor, interestingly enough, there are again two poems. One is devoted to Good Friday and the second to Pentecost. Guillain then says that he's profoundly Christian in Christ. And as he says, I don't know. He says, my poetry is open to the sky. I'm not anti-anything. I'm not atheistic or a-anything. But I just don't know. Honestly, I don't know. But I see the traces of God everywhere in the creation around me. And I keep always open the possibility that this grace might break in. Which is again extremely refreshing. We have, I mean, the dogmatic Christian writers, and we have the ferocious atheists, and we have those who are absolutely lukewarm. In the case of Guillain, it's not the case. But he believes as a human being, he must present the human reality in all its complexity as he sees it. In Clamor, there is a long poem called The Temptations of Anthony. You know, Saint Anthony. Usually have the temptations of Saint Anthony, who was a saint and was tempted, you know, by all kinds of alluring pin-ups and food, you know, and everything, all the goodies of life. Now this is not Saint Anthony, it is Anthony, just a human being called Anthony. And he has a long dream, and that's what the poem is about. The one temptation is a temptation of an angel who tempts Anthony with absolute purity. He says, "You are spirit, aren't you? You are pure spirit. Don't you want to leave this body and join God? Become one with the world soul again. Leave behind this dirty flesh and this valley of tears and all these injustices of time and history." The other temptation is the devil, who tempts him and says, "You don't really believe in the spirit, do you? You are just really an animal. I mean, wouldn't you like to indulge in your senses and your sensuality to the utmost? Forget about all those fairy tales. Stick to that which is really real, that you can touch and grasp." And then he awakes in the morning, and he decides to stay Anthony, which is somewhere in the middle between these extremes, right here in time and in the flesh, contradictory, confused, but a human being. And I think some of us really fall prey to these two temptations, and we really don't want to admit that our knowledge, our approach towards man and reality is profoundly dictated by the fact that we are human in the flesh, in the senses, that our very approach to truth is colored by. And so Guillen does not take any shortcuts out of this complexity, but stays somehow right in the center of the human predicament or the human condition. And that's what I admire so much in him. And from this center, he can explore the possibilities of praise, of lament, and of homage. And it's this wholeness, you know, which I think is something that we need to be reminded of again and again. Because just as we have specialists in the sciences and in technology, we have specialists of despair and absurdity, you know, with us. And I don't think that they have the last word. I think there'll be quite a few poets in the first half of the 20th century who are now very famous and will be soon quite forgotten. They'll have a historical importance, I think. But there are some poets, like the Russian Boris Pasternak or Jorge Guillén, who I think will continue to grow because we only have to make a bend in the road and suddenly we'll look at the world with different eyes, in a different light. And then suddenly we'll find quite a few forerunners and precursors who have seen this new reality. But we were kind of blinded, caught in the contemporary predicaments. I'd like to read you one more poem by Guillén, this time a very short one. No, I will not read you a poem by Guillén, I'll read you Guillén's preface, excuse me. This preface by Guillén himself on page 8. In the first part he talks about his background and what he has wanted to do when he wrote his poetry, but here he kind of tries to sum up his position. And I think it's a position that is really extremely important, even if it doesn't have all the implications that Christians would draw. But the same way as McGill says, I mean, if a poet writes vigorous original poetry and sees man in a larger context universal, a Christian can learn from him a great deal. So on page 8, Guillén says, "What is Cantico, this dialogue between man and the world, trying to say? Man knows himself only through his contact with the beyond. He sees himself inescapably caught up in something that infinitely surpasses him. Hence his wonderment. Above all, Cantico is a song in praise of the oneness of all beings. Whoever experiences this oneness can never feel isolated. One must cherish and advance this privilege of being among all things that have being, of sharing in their fullness. Man affirms himself in affirming creation. He shares in a universal value, though his part will always be the lesser. This basic intuition is not restricted to persons who are endowed with a special sensitivity. There is no mysticism here. No experience is more ordinary. It is so ordinary, in fact, that we tend to be oblivious of it and pass our days without giving thought to this foundation on which we rest. Only when it is interrupted do we notice the balance in our everyday lives and our everyday surroundings. Otherwise, it is as if nothing were happening. Nothing. Only the array of forces that join together with incredible certainty. Up to a point, the human animal succeeds in fitting into his environment, and this adjustment between his eyes and the light of day, between his lungs and the air, between his feet and the ground, involves a coordination so obvious that even the most observant persons are barely aware of it. This harmony does not clamor for man's attention. Yet no harmony is greater than our familiar equilibrium. Cantico is about these moments in which nothing occurs but the extraordinary phenomenon of normality. There are poets really who have written about extreme conditions, you know, extreme pain, extreme joy. But really, the fact that we are here, you know, healthy in mind and in body, is really a miracle. If you think of how many things had to come together to bring you in your personal life to this point, to Holden, what could have gone wrong in your life, in your biography? It's really incredible. But how few people sing praises of this miracle of balance and normality? Very few. It's not interesting. You know, when you suffer, when you are sick, when you are ecstatic, that's interesting. And Guillain's tremendous discovery is to write poetry out of the center of the equilibrium of normal life. In one line he speaks of the energy of normalcy. You know, when we speak of normal, we think it's kind of lukewarm. You know, well, just normal. You're just too darn healthy, you know? You know, get sick. Then you become interesting. You can be a poet. But if you really become aware of the marvel, the miracle of the normal, if you see it in an energetic, in a creative way, then you can't really exhaust it. Let's go on here in this. On such occasions, a joy both physical and metaphysical bursts forth, becomes a joy, becomes the basis of an enthusiastic conviction, a faith, faith in reality, in the reality of this earth. I'll skip them here and move on. Cantico assumes a relatively balanced relation between a sane and free protagonist and a world in plumb. But this relationship exists within a field of conflicting forces. So he sees that. The luminous center on which our attention converges is besieged. Disaster and disorder, affliction and evil, time and death, all do their damage and upset the balance, wrecking the symmetry. When men nullify the chaos, there is a world. But such moments are not always attained, for everything is subject to compromise within the conflicts of history. In disorder, evil is always at work, and therefore the world's vision must be ethical. This is the faith that sustains Cantico. Evil does not prevail. He says, all these destructive and negative influences make up the chorus of Cantico, a chorus of minor voices, subordinate to the singing voice. Affirmation of reality rises above the medley of bitterness, for man never gives in to cowardly resignation. But positive and negative values are not dissociated. They meet in this unifying vision. Cantico emphasizes an attachment to reality as it is. Man does not submit to his enemies without a contest. Cantico erects a bulwark for the effort of being, for the struggle against non-being. The gift of life is not taken for granted. Above all, one exercises the will to live. Cantico a song, then, in praise of contemplation and action, both directed toward one end alone, to bring to life the awareness of the wholeness of being on this earth. What happens in Cantico? Nothing more than the huge converging of creation. Anyone contemplating this convergence could sum up his amazement in very few words. It's a well-made world. The world as a glory of creation, which understands its shortcomings and its excellence. Yet nothing is truer than that. The world of man is badly made. Not that other world, however, which is superior to man. Never in Cantico are society and creation confused, and we do it all the time. There is not a single line concerning the accumulated past or present of history. That comes in Clamorius in the second volume. Cantico is an act of attentiveness. Despite many obstacles, it tends toward serenity, toward joy, with wonder and with gratitude. Experience of being, affirmation of life, of this life on earth, which has a value in itself and now. Cantico, a song of praise. And just one short poem, 12 o'clock. And here you can see the religious root, I think, of Guillain's poetry emerging. And he said himself, I didn't believe that I could read really Cantico in religious terms as you do. I wrote to him a long interpretation. But he says, you're right. And this is one place, he said, where it emerges. 12 o'clock. I declared everything in fullness now. A lone poplar stirred, its silvery leaves sounding with love. The greens were grays, the love was sunlight. And then, noonday, a bird immersed his song in the wind with such adoration that beneath the winds the flower felt itself sung, growing among the tallest grain. It was I at that moment center of so much surrounding who saw everything complete for a god. There it is, I said. Complete. It was 12 o'clock. It isn't 12 o'clock yet, but it's 9:30. Thank you. Well, if you have any questions about Guillain, or those who leave, please leave, and or take a stretch. Any questions on Guillain, or what I've said here about poetry and modern literature, please. Yes, go ahead.
I have a question on Allen Ginsberg and his poetry, and what your opinion is of it.
I think he's a very confused kid. Let me go on. I think he's a very sincere man. I mean, there's no doubt about that. He tries to face the modern confusion, and he reflects the confusion in his poetry, you know. But he is definitely combating it, you know, and there are moments of real joy, you know, and serenity in his poetry, and I think in his later poetry they come to dominate more and more. And I think they're not only the result of LSD, you know, they are in part influenced by his, you know, love for Zen Buddhism and so on, but I think he began, you know, just kind of shouting, you know, against the injustices of the world, and complaining and lamenting them. But I think he's moving in the direction of a more balanced view of life. And I think it is this assertion of joy, kind of creative kind of joy amidst confusion, and absurdity almost that many young people admire in him, and that speaks to them, you know. And that really breaks forth. I mean, that he is not just reflecting the dissonances, but that he is able to break through kind of to an affirmation. And I estimate that very, very highly. And I think this is very often overlooked by the people who just, you know, think of Howell and those and the early things that Ginsberg did. So I think this is really his real secret and his real strength, because the negative, destructive aspect wouldn't fascinate so many young people. Would you agree?
No.
Yes. You talk now. I'm dry. Yes.
How do we amateurs know when we're reading good poetry as opposed to that which isn't so good? But how do we begin this?
Well, I think the only recipe is you must read more and more. You know, really, I mean, you develop a taste, you know, with reading, and not just the, of course it helps, I think, if you read good criticism, and if you have had courses in literature, certainly. But I think if you are interested at all in poetry, just reading, you know, reading a great deal, you'll begin to develop, I think, you know, certain preferences. And the same way with music, you know, many people really don't have a, you know, real training in music. And they begin sometimes, you know, with Tchaikovsky, you know, and then they graduate to Bach, finally. You know? And this happens in the life of many people. And they, looking back, and they just don't know what to do with the Tchaikovsky records, you know, in Swan Lake, you know, their collection, and was embarrassed by it. And no one really led them or guided them or prodded them, you know, but just listening and listening, you just feel, well, you have exhausted Tchaikovsky. So you want something that you can hear more often, you see, it's more complex. And so I think quite a few people have grown to appreciate very sophisticated classical music without any kind of special prodding. And I think the same thing can happen also in poetry. If you just kind of read widely, and read, I mean, bad poetry and good poetry, and just take the risk. I think this is not a bad advice, really. It's just like if you start, you know, monkeying around with wines, if you're not Norwegian, then you begin to develop a taste, you know, and it takes time, really. I mean, you know, you hear a connoisseur, you know, who says, oh, this has a marvelous bouquet, and you just can't, you know, compare the 52 with the 53, you know, vintage, and you just watch like a tennis match, you know. What are these two guys talking about, you know? And then if you kind of don't become a drunkard, but a connoisseur, you develop a palate, you know? And I think the same with poetry. I really don't think there is a... courses help, criticism help, introduction helps, you know, but ultimately I think you have to kind of savor yourself and finally dare to say, I think this is good poetry, you know, even if you say it isn't so, you know, and maybe next year you will change your mind, you know, but unless you yourself taste it, you know, and like it, no authority, you know, who says, I mean, even Guillén, I mean, I like Guillén very much, you see, but maybe, I mean, he doesn't appeal to you. Now, I have read poetry a great deal and many years of it, and I have come kind of to appreciate the balance and the restraint of Guillén. I usually begin with kind of romantic and exuberant poetry, you know, and then you kind of graduate to, and I would say Guillén comes very close to Bach, you know, and his design, his idea of counterpoint and restraint. What not everybody likes, you see, Bach, not everybody likes Guillén. I don't know whether that's a good answer, you know, but I have no magic really, and no one book that I could give into your hand. And
can you understand? Are you supposed to be able to understand a poem, even if you haven't read the background of the author, you know, or what situation you wrote it, or what you were thinking about? Should you be able to understand it, or is something wrong with you? You can't understand.
Well, I would say there are poems, you know, that are written out of very personal situation, you know, and where it helps. Have the, you know, personal kind of things explained behind it, or again poems that allude to historical things, you know, or to readings of the poet, and if you don't know those readings, it doesn't give you any thrill. But I would say really, as a rule of thumb, a poem must stand, I mean, on its own merits. It must have, I mean, a universality that is accessible to a person who is intelligent, open, and sensitive. if that isn't enough, if you need a handbook, you know, endless explanations, then I would say that the poem is very limited in its appeal. It may be interesting, but it's limited. For example, the haikus, you know, that we read here, some of you. A Japanese would point out, I mean, all kinds of Zen Buddhist mysteries there. I mean, every line, every little word means something else. Every sound almost, you know, evokes something. Still, we like the poems, you know. I mean, they're marvelous. They're fresh. They're concrete. I mean, we see also the symbolism in the concrete. We can manage that. But what the symbolism exactly is, we don't know because we don't have this Buddhist background. But it doesn't hurt, see. So, and the one point that McGill makes with the wasteland, where you have footnotes, you know, for all the sources that Eliot used, and he really used them there because they have two pages, you know, were blank in the edition, and so he just added footnotes, you know, he thought would send the professors, you know, on a wild goose chase, and would just appreciate it, you know. And sure enough, you know, for 30 years, 40 years now, professors are teaching the footnotes to the wasteland, you know, and not reading the wasteland. Because it's so marvelous to talk about the Holy Grail legends that are in there, and the tarot cards, you know, and Fraser's Golden Bough, and you can just dazzle your students, you know, to a frazzle. It's tremendous. But McGill says, read the poem aloud. And if there are quotes in German or in French, they represent part of the confusion of a city dweller. Urban Alexandrian kind of temper, and you don't have to know whether it's a quote from Richard Wagner. I mean, later, if you're curious, you might look up. You know, it adds something to it. But really, it these quotes from foreign languages reveal a certain confusion in the modern mind, which Eliot wanted to evoke. But basically, it is an English poem, and it must be read aloud, and its meaning is revealed. Quite a bit is revealed just in a good reading of it. Yes?
You began by saying that life is tragic, or life is a tragedy. Were you reflecting your own point of view, or the point of view of contemporary literature, or what?
Both. Both. I think, I mean, that...
Is it a tragedy because there is disappointment and frustration? Is it a tragedy because it ends?
No, I'm glad you asked this. What I mean by it is that we all agree that life on this earth, you know, and here in time is not paradise, right? And it certainly isn't a comedy. I think there are tragic tensions because we do live in a fallen world, speaking theologically, in a world that is torn between good and evil, you know, between intention and realization, that therefore life must have this drama, maybe not tragedy is the right word, drama, you know, this dramatic tension, you know, dramatic tension. Because real tragedy in the Greek sense, of course, presupposes a worldview that is religious, you know, I mean, and the catharsis, right, which very often isn't the case in modern literature. So I would say, I mean, that life is difficult, that it's dramatic, that it is war, that it is tension, you know. I mean, we all agree. Now, what do you do with this kind of basic kind of understanding? And I think quite a few of the modern artists stop at that point. You know, they say it's dissonance, it's disorganization, and then they just scream. And I just think, that's fine, I can scream too. You know, we all can scream. That doesn't make a genius. I think from a genius, I expect a transformation of these tensions, you know. Some kind of to add something, I mean, something kind of creative element that points a way towards catharsis or a solution or indicates that this is not all of life, which I think it isn't simply not all of life. It's a one-sided view of reality. And I appreciate it in Guillain, that in Pasternak, that in Wallace Stevens, you have a more complex view of life. They're not denying the presence of evil, or tension, or war, or death. But they also see the glory of creation. They see amidst the moments of dissonance, the moments of fulfillment and harmony. I think they're just simply plain honest. And I appreciate it in Guillain, that in Pasternak, that in Wallace Stevens, you have a more complex view of life. They're not denying the presence of evil or tension or war or death. But they also see the glory of creation. They see amidst the moments of dissonance the moments of fulfillment and harmony. I think they're just simply plain honest.
You said something earlier in your lecture that I might feel much patient on something. I can't reconstruct exactly the way you said it, but you were calling attention to the fact that you raised the question as to whether or not some of the things that have happened in the world, I presume you were referring to atomic energy and H bomb, I think you mentioned, and the question was raised whether this had any change on the reality of God, and you said something, if I remember correctly, to the effect that the poets were giving were saying no, that it hadn't changed, and many theologians were saying that it had changed,
yes,
the picture. Now I'd like a little more clarification.
Well, I try to clarify after that statement, you know, but...
Now, in what respect were you suggesting that many clergy, you didn't say clergy, you said theologians.
Yes, that's right. They feel, you know, that, well, the very fact that God is dead, you see, this statement coming, you know, from quite a few theologians, is I think, kind of a reflection, you know, that they feel that we are in a completely new kind of relationship, you know, to God, you see, and to the Bible, which hasn't somehow, you know, been existed before.
Well, correct, but you...
I don't see that.
Well, I go along with this.
Yes.
But you would limit that application to some theologians.
Yes, that's what I said. I said, you see, some theologians, some philosophers, some writers, you see, believe that because of certain things, you know, atomic energy, you know, and these terrible murders, this unleashing of evil, that our age is somehow unique. And therefore, you know, we must see man in a completely new light. You know, I think they are kind of, you know, setting this age above all other ages, as if we couldn't learn something from the past, as if philosophers and theologians and poets in the past hadn't grappled with the problem of evil and death, you know, and whether the destruction comes in the form of an atomic bomb, you know, or the Huns, you know, sweeping in from Asia, you know, into Europe. I personally don't see, you know, that there is such a big difference. Of course, it's a different thing. The H-bomb is unique. Probably there never was an H-bomb before, you know. But to say because of the H-bomb, because of certain discoveries, modern man is in a special, you know, category and must have a completely different kind of treatment and relation to God and so forth. I can see that. I think man is basically man.
Well, I think that the reason I'm going to question about this is that the theologians who take the view that man is an individual, I think, are a minority.
Yes, right.
Minority.
Yes.
The average clergyman and the average theologian, at least in the Orthodox school,
yes,
still hold the same reports. We stand with reports that man is still man.
Yes.
And that God is still God.
Yes.
And all we have is an increased knowledge of God's power, but it doesn't change the situation.
Yes, I would agree with you. I would agree with you. Yes, certainly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh yes. No, I'm glad you asked that, because, you know, if you make this kind of summed up, you know, my observations, you know, from quite a bit of reading, and then you make statements that are, you know, rather wide generalizations, and so you must have, I mean, footnotes, you know, and
sure,
explanations. Otherwise, it's just things hang in the air.
But isn't there a development of evil in our day that I can't think of any point in human history where people of culture, of poets, philosophers, religion, teachers, cold-bloodedly kill 5-6 million Jews. There is an intensity of evil in our day.
Yes.
But I think we can't blink away.
Right.
It's a reality that it horrifies us.
Yes.
It makes you wonder exactly what the human frame is capable of doing.
Yes.
I agree fully with what you've said about this other side but I can't quite feel that the picture of man throws us deep into the iniquity of this possibility of evil as our own age has done. It would be different if you say this happened 1,000, 1,500 years ago, or even our conception of man as an animal, which is part of our theory today. I can't think of animals doing what men have done.
Yes.
I know that this doesn't help us, but you've got to see the blackness in order to appreciate the whiteness.
Yeah, of course, absolutely. Yes, I agree with you, but I don't know really. I mean, so many, you know, peoples, you know, I think have disappeared. The Tartars and the Huns, you know, I mean.
They didn't claim to be philosophers.
Oh, well, certainly not. Certainly not. Certainly not. But then again, you see, I would say that I mentioned this, you know, darkness and light, you know, I mean, that there's, you know, where there's new light, there's also an intense darkness, of course. There's a phrase. It's the first line of a poem by Hölderlin, the 19th century German poet, who ended in madness, you know. He wrote some of his finest poetry in moments when he kind of emerged from this madness. And his poems are considered completely obscure by the 19th century. And then the 20th century kind of discovered and found that he was really a prophet of the 20th century. And one of his poems, which is entitled Patmos, begins with a phrase, Wo aber Gefahr ist, wächst das Rettende auch. There, you know, where there is danger, grows also salvation, or the possibility of salvation, you know. This thing, and I think that because of this intensity of evil, quite a few people, I think, are also growing aware, you know, of the other powers that are with us.
Well, I think that's part of the Christian message. I know of no better philosophy of history than in the words of the parable where they come back to the husbandman and say, you planted good seed, how come that the weeds have grown?
Yes.
He says, let them both grow.
Mm-hmm.
I think both the evil of the world has grown and the right has grown.
Yes.
What I miss in this humanism of a very high level is the sense that we cannot lift ourselves by our own bootstraps.
Yes.
And that there must be a greater force that cooperates with us or we with it in overcoming the evil.
Mm-hmm.
I don't find that in the descriptions of the evil of our time. Certainly man is capable of the grace of God,
mm-hmm.
but you can't quite describe this grace without reference to it.
Yes.
Well, I don't believe in poetry that has Christ in every other verse.
Yes.
But sometimes it can become just mere stoicism.
Yes. Yes. Well, you see, this is, I mean, exactly what I feel, for example, in Guillén, you see, is that the strength that he has, I mean, that really it's a faith, it's a tremendous faith in the face of adversity and persecution. His love, humanism alone isn't capable of producing it. And he agrees to it. He says, you know, really, he said, you're right, I'm profoundly Christian Christ, but because he says, well, I don't agree with the dogmatic positions of the Catholic Church, you know, he believes he's not really a Christian. Well, I had an argument with him in his letters, you know. Sometimes a poet can be more modest, really, you know, and it's better that he's modest than overly claiming too much, you know. And I would say that in his case, I personally experience in his poetry not as merely a humanist praising kind of the human sphere and saying that this is really, I mean, kind of we should approach this with serenity and kind of a stoical kind of attitude, but there is an intensity, I mean, that goes beyond that, you know, it goes beyond that. And this is what I appreciate very much in him. And when really pressed, I mean, he agrees to it. But, you know, we have had easy conversions, like Claudel, you know, the French poet Claudel, I mean, who was a very interesting poet, and he was converted, and he just really lost his poetic powers. Eliot, too, I think, lost quite a bit of his poetic powers, I mean, in his later work. And they claimed so much for their faith. And on the other hand, I mean, you have this violent atheism. And Guillén is just somehow staying here in the middle and doesn't claim more than he absolutely can. Miss
Don't you think, too, that I really like the fact that he uses the word praise and gratitude and creation,
yes,
all of which, I mean, indicate, to whom would he be praising? I mean, he
right.
doesn't say this,
right.
Hey, this is the person.
Yes.
I mean, he's not saying this, but this to me is one of the deepest witnesses that anyone gives in an off-the-cuff kind of way.
Yes.
Of his faith, because one of Carol's and my favorite quotations is from Catherine Mansfield, who was a prose writer of
yes.
the 20s,
mm-hmm.
and
no
one of the despairing atheists, mm-hmm. but who also did have a lot of affirmation in her life that she
mm-hmm.
could find no answer for.
Yes.
And she said one day in her, looking at the mountains, she said, oh, to be able to have faith enough so that you could thank a God
mm-hmm.
for all this.
Yes.
And this, you see, is what is in his poetry is this continual thankfulness and gratitude. He's not grateful to man.
No.
He's not grateful to the world. He continually refers to it as creation.
Yes.
I mean, this implies the creator.
Absolutely. Oh yes. Oh,
I
yes.
mean, all this is so kind of. I'm not trying to read it into the truth.
No.
But what I mean is that I think it's
Oh yeah. Well, he would absolutely agree to this, you know, and these two phrases that occur in his poetry, that the world is well made, and he means the world of creation, but the world of man is poorly made, you know. And now there's not a contradiction. I mean, one must try to improve the one, but also be ready to give praise to the other. You see, and this is exactly, I mean, his secret. I think anybody who has such an insight and such a wisdom as Guillén has, is so open that he possibly cannot overlook, you know, the existence of God, really, you know. And there is a humility in the man. I know him quite well. As a matter of fact, I mean, I learned Spanish because of him. I fell in love with his poetry. I read a few. I studied some Latin and some French, and I found in a magazine, which a friend edited, a few poems of his in Spanish, and I could read them quite well, you know, because the Latin and French helps. And then I went to the University of Minnesota, and I remember this little day in the stacks when I picked up the first Cantico. And I started paging, you know, and so much of it right away struck me. And so I went and studied some Spanish, and started studying more Spanish literature. Then I met Guillén himself. I met him several times, and a long correspondence ensued, which is still continuing today. I translated him into Estonian. I've written about his poetry in English, and Estonian, and German. And it all was because I fell in love with his poetry, you know. And you really can learn a language, and he has really given me as a gift, so to speak, Spanish literature, the language, and kind of opened the whole Mediterranean world, which very often for a person from the north is closed, you know. We come from this Lutheran, Scandinavian background, and we tend to kind of see the Mediterranean as an exotic thing, you know, or then again an exclusively Catholic or pagan or, you know, kind of a dubious affair. And he really kind of opened up this world for me. And so I feel at home very much in Spain, as I feel in Italy and in Greece, as much as I feel at home in Estonia and in Finland, and of course in Austria, Germany, as is my main teaching field. So once you kind of are really open to the influence, you fall in love with something and you kind of go out of your way, you receive more than you almost bargained for.
I think just celebrating this fundamental note that you have of affirmation that God is God, no matter what. You have this sense here, I feel.
Yes.
Not a holy language, Norwegian, the oldest Christian poet is Peter Doss, and his most famous hymn starts just that way. Gud er Gud om all among
or do they lose their view from all along, or do they? And God is still God, though every man were dead. God is still God, though every land were destroyed. And
yes,
this confidence that you have in God, this will permit you an affirmation, I think. And this is what you feel, I mean, that he is affirming,
yes,
creation, and that God,
right,
is it.
Right.
It's Kierkegaard's last laugh again from the Diplomata, that the existentialists forget. That he isn't a graveyard philosopher.
No. Well, that's what Tillich says in one of his sermons, you know, I mean, he speaks of the joy that is really in the depth, you know, once you really have gone through, I mean, suffering, I mean, in the depth is joy. And it's also in Pasternak, I mean, you feel this, I mean, here's a man, I mean, who has gone through the hell of Stalin's Russia, and who ends with an affirmation of creation and of the relevance, you know, of the Christian gospel for our day and age. So it seems, this is what, I mean, makes me very, very suspicious of some of these existentialist so-called, you know, bards, who just, all they can speak is of the nausea, you know, of the world and creation. Because here you have some men, like Guillen, like Pasternak, or Tillich, who really have seen evil, and destruction, and despair. But who end, who come out of this, you know, with faith and affirmation. So you just wonder, you know, whether some of these well-fed, you know, Parisian intellectuals or San Francisco, you know, poets, whether they really, I mean, have suffered that much, you know, whether they really have thought through things to the point they really can declare the world as null and nihil, you know, and void. This is my suspicion. I mean, I respect suffering and lament, I mean, when it really comes out of the depth of the heart very much. And but I just don't admire very much anybody who just lets go, you know, and without having lived very much or seen very much, just makes these sweeping declarations of meaninglessness and absurdity. Yes.
Something that Dr. Rubendorf said about the evil of cultured race slaughtering 5 million Jews, is this a symptom or a progression of evil in the world that we should maybe take note of? I can't see that there's any degree of evil. Evil is evil, and 5 million Jews are no worse than Cain slaying Abel. Unless we accept that we are progressing towards the end, which I guess we all are, we see all kinds of evil there, but is this something that we should dwell on or just acknowledge that we are evil and we're full of evil? This is probably more theological than poetical.
No, it's a very legitimate question. It concerns me very much, very deeply. I mean, it's. I think that our definition of man, you know, is being redefined, you know. I mean, by theologians and by poets and by writers, and it was a too narrow one, you know. And there was kind of a cheap, simple optimism, you know, that the world, you know, is good and it's moving, you know, towards a better of all worlds. And somehow he believed that the Germans themselves believed, you know, that they really were cultured. And you know the famous phrase of the Germans, well, it was Goethe, I think, who used it first, that we are a nation of poets and thinkers, you know, Dichter und Denker. And the Jewish satirist from Vienna, Karl Kraus, changed it to Richter und Henker, judges and hangmen. That we really are a nation of judges and hangmen, not of poets and thinkers. Just changing the first, you know, consonant. So I think praise that does not have the background of lament and despair, goodness without the profound experience of evil, light without shadow, I mean, or in this case I would say an assertion of the goodness of man, of creation, without taking into consideration this tremendous, I mean, propensity for evil, is meaningless, you know. It's meaningless. So I think what we have experienced is a corrective of a very one, of a too optimistic view of man. You know, this is what history had to teach us, unfortunately, because we ourselves didn't want to see unflinchingly the reality. And I think that modern theology, I mean, in Niebuhr, you know, for example, I mean, is really, really seeing this. And so I would say, whenever, yeah. Oh, thank you. Is it coffee?
Yeah, can we
take
it tonight?
I think not. I won't sleep. I have to get up at 6 o'clock, go to Lyman, and praise.
Tomorrow.
Affirm the mountains.
You better eat a cookie.
I'll eat a cookie. Yeah. Thank you.
Do you want me to put some milk in it, and maybe you could bring
yeah,
it over?
Yeah.
Also, I seem to sense that Dr. Bergendorf was shocked that poets and thinkers could commit such a great evil. I'm not surprised that poets and thinkers could commit evil any more than Huns and barbarians. They have basically the same evil nature.
Yes.
They just because they can think better, they can think up bigger evils.
Well, I wouldn't want to locate this matter. It's Niebuhr has told us that all of us are capable of the same things. And that, what frightens us is that we might be doing exactly what they are doing without knowing it. And I think, in a sense, we are. There's a conference being held these days in Geneva, the World Conference on Church and Society. I just got today a resume of a speech by a African who's pleaded on behalf of the smaller nations of the world not to have to suffer a world that is dominated by the rivalry of Russia and the United States. He said the rest of us in the world have reason to live and have our future careers without being drawn into your great world conflict. I think there is something in Fulbright's statement. There is an arrogance in America that we are not aware of, and that we're always on the precipice of despair and defeat, and therefore we need so much more the grace of God. Ultimately and fundamentally, Christianity is dualistic, as over against the Greek idea that after all the world is a harmony, and if you see it in its proper light, everything fits together. There is in the scriptures a dualism between right and wrong, which is a conflict that we cannot avoid. And I can't quite see how a Christian can see history unless he feels himself involved in this. I'm certainly thankful for any statement such as this, and any poet who gives you hope. I'm just asking, how far does that help the rest of us in finding the strength that we need in our country?
His main point is simply, you see, a very old-fashioned point, but I think you are really attacking me. You're just talking about but simply, I mean, well, he simply says you don't give in to evil. I mean, man's nature, you see, his nobility somehow, inherent kind of, you know, godlikeness, you want to say, is not to give in to evil. And at the moment, it seems that some just thrive in this, you know, and exult in it, and just give in, you know. Instead of saying it is a tension, it is something to be fought out, and every victory, every moment, I mean, where you can kind of, where goodness wins over evil, I mean, it's something to be celebrated, you know. It seems that somehow it's fashionable nowadays, you know, just, you know, to say, well, evil has grown to this intensity, we just give in, you know. It's just absurd, and meaningless, you know. And
Christian certainly doesn't.
No.
We believe that he overcomes the world, no matter what the world is.
This is exactly it. I remember, I mean, when existentialism, this Sartrean existentialism was sweeping into Germany, After the war, I was a student in Marburg, and my teacher, I never will forget this, he said, well, it's very interesting as far as the existential analysis goes, about the anxiety of the world, about its meaninglessness, you know, and so on. But he says, since I am a Christian, he was a Jew, converted Jew, I can only quote, he says, the analysis, existentialist analysis in the Bible, and also the answer. That in the world, I know we're quoting right, you know, you will be afraid. Right? But I have overcome.
Be of good cheer.
You know, I mean, this, you see. So, that's a very said there, right? I mean, you will be afraid.
The question is, where do you get the strength to get this feeling of faith?
Well, I have to say in Christ.
Yes.
Certainly. And this, I mean, he then admits too. Yes?
Oh, excuse me. Finish yours.
No, this.
But Stevens doesn't.
Stevens doesn't. But I would say, I mean, that unwittingly, where does he get, I mean, this exaltation, you see? And you have very often a false kind of a shame, you know, in some of these poets who that isn't fashionable nowadays, to claim, you know, allegiance to Christ, I mean, or strength coming from there. But whenever I think anybody affirms the world, not merely as matter, you know, but as creation, and says, well, really, I'm not a Christian, he is strengthened, you know, by sources of his unawares, almost.
Dean,
so I would say,
Dean Sperry of Harvard said once that this generation's living on the spiritual coupons of former generations.
I would agree with that very much. Very much so. Yes?
The point that I would like to raise, it seems like much of our society today, we're so concerned, let's say, about the destruction, or we feel, for example, like, again, not a poet, but an author, something like Harvey Cox,
mm-hmm.
destroying,
yes.
and then starting to build.
Mm-hmm.
But would you advocate here the construction rather than going through the destructive stage first? Although, in a sense, we know that there will always be this conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there will be peace, let's say, at the end of time.
Yes.
But until that time, there will always be this tension. But this factor here of doing something that is constructive without destroying first.
Well, that's a very, very important question. I would answer it this way, that I am not for a revolution, you know, that is a total destruction, you know, a tabula rasa. I would say that, and this is not my thought, that the most perfect revolutionary, you know, whoever was, is Jesus Christ. Because what did he do? He destroyed, you know, destroyed that which was dead, you know, already, I mean, dead or dying, and yet saved, you know, from the past, from the Old Testament, right? Fulfilled, you know, what was promised there, and carried over the best of the old into the new. You know, so I think you really can't have continuity without real life, I mean, without continuity, you know. And so I think some of these revolutionaries who kind of preach a complete destruction, then we'll begin all anew, you know. I think this is not just heresy, it's hubris, you know. I don't agree with this at all, but I think that I would say that if there is will for renewal, you know, and I would say that some revolutionary spirit is the spirit of renewal, this renewal, if it's intense enough, it will break forth, you know, and that which is old will fall away like husks, you know. I mean, it's like a fruit, you know, it just pops, you know, there it is. Very often I find the revolution is just going through the motions of destroying everything. They really don't have nothing to put in the place, you know. And I think if there is, I believe more than kind of this kind of organic, you know, kind of, you know, development, if there's really will towards renewal, and another truth, another view, you know, of life, it will slowly push it aside, you know, just open, you know, this, you just can't hold it away, you just can't stop it. You have very often this kind of this, especially in the younger generation, I mean, you have this despair with the organic growth and development of things. And a disregard for continuity. They aren't even aware, as this statement, you know, that we live on the coupons, you know, the faith of the past generations, you know, that so many of the revolutionary gestures have come from the past, you know. So I would disagree with this very much, you know. It's like the futurists in 1907, I mean, the futurists, who were really the first ones to start, you know, then came Expressionism, Surrealism, and all these things. The Marinetti, Italian theorist, well, he said, let's destroy the museums, let's destroy the Acropolis, let's burn Mona Lisa, and let's extol the future, I mean, the plane that, you know, sweeps the skies beautiful, you know, I mean, let's forget about the junk, let's bomb, you know, the cathedrals, the Gothic, I mean, domes, away with them. We have worshipped enough, you know, the past. Well, I think this is awfully silly. Because if you have to assert your newness by destroying, you know, which preceded you, and certainly they haven't erected one cathedral, the futurists, that can measure up the Chartres, you know, the Acropolis, as the temple goes. So there is this
anarchist.
Yes, anarchist. I mean, because really, I mean, there again, you see, I mean, like operation. I mean, an operation really, I mean, cuts. I mean, you know, a certain area, right? But then destroy the whole organism. I mean you cut out certain thing in order to heal it. I mean, or like a good gardener, he wants to make the tree grow a certain way, but he knows how deep to cut, you know, because if you cut deep into it, then it will die. I mean, you can do all kinds of things. The tree is pliable, I mean, so is a human organism to a certain point. But some of these social reformers and so forth, I mean, they really put this, what a straitjacket, they put them on that.
This is very important, this that you brought out. When I started this is one aspect that I didn't mention, but I thought about before, that there may have to be a cutting away.
Yes.
But a total destruction, this is and where
that's
we...
That's the easy way out. Total destruction is the easy way out.
And that then, a simple answer, destroy, and then that will solve our problem.
Yes, I know. I mean, one can lose patience, you see, with the complexity of the human predicament.
You haven't changed man in the past.
No. And yet at the same time, getting back to what Pastor Berndorf had said, that that we do have to rely on the strength of Christ, and in this conflict still keep struggling with it and grappling with the complexity. And yet look at reality and see the good and evil, but not to be pulled to one side or the other. So we kind of flop from one ditch into the other.
And I don't think despair and destruction are ever creative.
No.
I mean,
The scapegoat, the Jews. Get rid of the Jews. We've solved the problem.
That's exactly it. I mean, I would say I'm all for operations, you know. You know, operations, I mean, that cut away that which is dead, you know, hindering, I mean, the organism. Let out the pus, you know. That's one thing. But another thing is, I mean, you know, to operate, I mean, so wildly until the patient dies on your hands, you see. And this is...
successful operation.
That's right. Yeah.
I don't want to interrupt this, but... Dr. Ivask is going to Lyman Lake tomorrow morning, and he's leaving at 6:30, and he did not get a nap because there was a strong painting going on next to him today. So I think we should, I don't want to cut off a creative discussion, but I also don't want to spoil a creative fight.
All of them. I survived.
Are you?
Yeah, I think
so. I just wanted you to feel perfectly free to leave whenever you want to. So.
Well, I think we did some talking, so... So you can continue on Sunday night.
Go on. Talking will stop, I'm sure.
Are you coming back next
Thank
summer?
Thank you so much.
I don't think so. I will be gone for 2 summers and a year in Europe. So I don't know what will happen after that.